In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
To EMS Office Hours. This is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp.
And we also have David Brenner with us. Dave, hello.
Hey, hi, everybody.
All right. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, guys. We're at EMS Safe on Twitter. You can chat. You can get in tweet during the show, and we can. I'll be checking that to see if anybody makes any comments during the show. And also, don't forget that this episode of EMS Office Hours is sponsored by EMS Manager. You can get a free trial of their software. It's employee management software at emsmanager.net. Well, guys, this is going to be actually the last show
of the year.
Yeah, 2013.
That's it. That's it. I'm done, Jim. I'm done. I'm not doing any more shows this year.
Yeah. So the recording is going to be on Wednesday, which I think is actually New Year's Day, right? And Wednesday's New Year's Day, right?
So if you're listening to this and it's not live and you're listening to the recorded, well,
yeah. Happy New Year.
You know, Happy New Year. Right?
Happy New Year regardless.
If indeed.
The recording, yeah. If you listen to the recording or live, one, just say Happy New Year to you. You know.
So you guys have plans for New Year's? I'm sure you do, Jim.
Yeah, I've got some plans for New Year's.
Dave?
I'm going to be on patrol.
No, you are not.
I am.
Not like EMS-y patrolling?
Yeah.
No. What's wrong with you? You had enough years seniority, you don't have to do it anymore.
It's true, but it also means if I want to do it, I get first choice.
Oh, okay. All right, I can go with that. I can tell you what I'm not doing.
Oh, you're not going to be on EMS.
Yeah, I'm not going to be working EMS, right? For sure.
Let me tell you something. There's just one holiday I don't enjoy working. It's New Year's Eve or New Year's Day.
You know, the last time that I just said give it to me, you know, for the abuse, and I actually worked a 1-2 double, you know, New Year's Eve into New Year's Day. And let me tell you something, that started out like I was working in Washington Heights, and that was one of the surrealistic, you know, almost a shot out of a movie. People were partying in the streets. They were lighting garbage cans on fire. Cars were, you know, hitting things randomly. And it was capped off the evening by this group of people who stole a car, couldn't get it started, and then left it in neutral to roll down a hill where I was called when it pinned this guy against hit a guy and pinned him. Mind you, it wasn't running or operated, but it was pinned him against one of these metal security gates, blew open his cap. So, you know, it was one of those compression type injuries, so the muscles separated, but he could still move his feet with the tendon. You could see the tendons moving and stuff, and it was it was actually really cool. But the funny part was he was saying, "Hey, listen,
for
guys,
you, not for him."
You know, no, he was like drunk off his face, and he said, "Listen, I just want to hang out with my peeps. Can you just put some tape on it and let me go?" And we were looking at him like, hey, you ain't going to be feeling that in a few hours, my friend.
But yeah, my last New Year's Eve that I worked, I ended up in the middle of a mini riot. So that was not good times.
Yeah, you know, for me. Celebrating the New Year's, bringing it in right.
Well, it was more like a response to the call when it gets out of control because everybody's drunk and then you call it 10:13. And you know you have an issue when you've got the firefighters that responded with you, you know, fighting with you on when you look up for a second and you're, it's like you have like an out-of-body experience and you just kind of see three firefighters in one corner fight with somebody, and a firefighter and a medic in another corner, and then two cops in another corner, and
Good times, man. Good times.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And then when you finally get out of the house, the entire street is blocked by ambulances and cops, cop cars, and both.
And this little story has been brought to you by OurJobsAren'tReallyDangerous.com.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, Dave, you're not planning any sort of night like that, I assume.
Probably not.
All right. I hope it's much more boring than that. Do you get many drunks out there on the in the South End there?
We don't allow drunks on Long Island.
Of course you get. I heard that.
You know, that keeps the whole situation much more controlled.
It's like an ordinance, I think. You can't have drunks.
Of course. And we don't have people overdosing on heroin all the time. Oh, wait a minute.
We do.
Don't get me started with that. That's a whole other topic.
We're not carrying Narcan anymore, because who needs that stuff? We need it. We want 55-gallon drums of that stuff.
You might actually talk about it. I might talk about that a little bit later, too. But
you spray it out of the top of a water cannon as you drive out there.
Wake up, everybody. It's funny, this last show of the year, I had a couple of topics that I wanted to cover and kind of touch on, but as I look along, looking at Facebook and stuff like that, I see a lot more topics that, might be fun to cover too. So
would you say it's a target-rich environment?
Yeah, you mentioned the Narcan thing, and I talk a little bit about that too. But one thing I wanted to talk about, two primary things. It's something that you posted on your page, Josh, and also this article that has been going around about this this EMT from a volley squad in upstate New York who was suspended and ended up resigning because he went ahead and drove an ambulance to another call.
How dare he respond to a call when he's not
pretty much to. Well, what happened was he ended up there were two calls that sounded kind of dropped about 5 minutes apart from each other. And one was for a pediatric having seizures, and one was for an 80-year-old person who was bleeding from their arm. And apparently this EMT was about 20 years old, under 21, and the squad's policy that they're not supposed to be driving vehicles, that he didn't have the authorization to divert one ambulance to a call versus another ambulance to a call. They ended up suspending him, the same, because he had other issues where he didn't play along with the squad's rules and regulations and all that stuff. Now, two things that irked me with this article. And, listen, this guy tried to, he worked for a paid service, but he volunteered. So he worked for a paid service, so he wasn't like he was, being a volunteer, and that was it. He also worked for a paid service, which is why the volunteers in the other truck seemed to listen to him, because they felt he had more experience and was, had more day-to-day experience, I guess, than they did. But the two things that irked me with this call. First one is a lot of the comments that I see on Facebook and even on the article website as well.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them they support this kid because they felt he did the right thing. He tried to field two calls that came in at once. The other theme that goes on in the comments, it seems as well, he might do the right thing, but, he did go against policy and, he should have been suspended. It shouldn't just, they have policies in place for a reason. And I can kind of agree with both sides of that.
But we're not robots.
Yeah, but the one thing that gets to me on all the comments and everything else is the fact that nobody said, that to me, this issue wouldn't even be there if they paid EMS to do the service.
Oh, you really went there, right?
If you had paid providers, paid ambulances to respond to calls in an area like that, you wouldn't have to worry about this type of issue, and you wouldn't be worrying about second dispatches and third dispatches and gathering personnel, you know, crew chiefs, drivers, EMTs, and the whole gaggle to go to respond to a call at 10:45 a.m. during the day. You know, so it's like everyone is overlooking this issue and saying, well, the kids did such a great thing and did the right thing for everybody. But that may be the case, but it's not addressing the fact that they didn't have two ambulances to respond to two calls.
Jim?
You know, so now you've got this four-year-old who's seizing, who doesn't have an ambulance to come. You know?
Right.
So,
but that was the wrong decision.
What's that?
The EMT made the decision to respond to an 80-year-old who was bleeding from his arm.
Right, exactly. He sent them to the other.
But Jim, this guy, you know, you're gonna get the guy who's gonna defend volunteers versus paid, although. I
don't necessarily think necessarily a volunteer.
This kid was paid. He has a job where he gets paid to be an EMT.
Yeah.
So he made it. It happens that he made the bad decision as a volunteer, but he would have made the same decision had he been paid.
Well, no. If he had been paid, he would have been in an ambulance with a partner, and they would have went to the call, and that would have been the end of it.
He was in an ambulance with a partner.
No, he didn't have a partner. He
had another EMT. Am I reading a different article?
Ellensville, 20-year-old Ellensville.
Yeah. From what I understand, his partners went along with him because they figured he had more experience because he was paid.
Well, he sent the other people. They went along with the fact to go to the other call. He stayed and took the other ambulance to go to the call with the pediatric and then had to wait there for another dispatch to get more personnel to the scene.
All right. Maybe when I sped through the weeding of this.
But my thing is it's not against him as a volunteer and trying to do the right thing. It's the fact that the system isn't working. If this is making headlines and there's an issue with proper response, the system's not working. The volunteer system doesn't work. Okay, you've got volunteers, you know, that are going to a squad building and making decisions on the fly, you know, based on their gut feeling or based on their experience or the excitement of the call, whatever the case may be, rather than having dispatched paid ambulances, dispatched according to priority and location and all that. You know, you've got. I've worked in this area, and I've worked in this area, and I can tell you that I've heard volley squads get toned out 3 times, 4 times, before they even go to mutual aid, the paid mutual aid agency.
Right.
You know, this is the thing that gets to me is that the. Not so much in the Facebook page, because that's other EMS people, and they're defending either the volley end of it, the paid end of it, the squad, whatever the case may be. But the article itself, you know, the public that's responding are blind to the fact that if it wasn't a volunteer, there would have been an efficient, proper response to each call. You know, instead of waiting to 2-3 dispatches to get all the people assembled at the squad building and then to tear ass to a call, lights and sirens, when the call had been going on for 10-15 minutes already, now it's all of a sudden it's a big emergency to start going lights and sirens to the call because everybody's together now.
Right.
You know, and to me, at 10 o'clock in the morning, there shouldn't be it. If it's a volunteer, you know, system, at 10:45 in the morning should not be an issue getting personnel to respond to a squad building, go to a call.
So I can draw from what you're saying, Jim, 2 things. One is that, you know, it's that old saying, who's more professional, or is one more professional, or, you know, professionals are more professional, sorry for the redundancy, than volunteers.
Wow.
And the other, right?
But I'm not trying to say that, though.
I'm not saying that's the way it is, Dave. I'm just saying that's what I'm drawing.
You got the whole, I'm sorry, I'm stuck on linguistics here.
Right.
I'm a professional. I don't get paid.
Right.
Okay, so yes, it's not professional, it's more professional. Are you talking about paid being more professional than volunteers?
You know what? Yes, that's better. Better linguistics.
That I completely disagree.
And I expect you to.
Yes.
But you know what? I think that over time when these things tend to happen, it may be just there's bigger numbers of volunteers than there are paid. But, you know, you sort of get these discrepancies, if you will, or these deviations on the theme that, people are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And I think that you get more of these stories involve volunteers just because it's a numbers game and there are more volunteers in the field.
But, Josh, you know what? I'm not saying – I don't think that people that volunteer are less professional than people that get paid. I mean, I've seen...
Well, it sort of sounded that way. I'm just saying.
No, I didn't... I'm not saying they're more professional.
Okay.
Like I said, I have nothing against the individual person or volunteers.
Just showing up to your inbox with angry emails. Remember, send them to Jim, not me.
Well, yeah, I'm going to get them. You don't shut your pie hole so I can finish the process here.
Go ahead.
The problem is it's not... I'm not saying that volunteers themselves are the issue. They want to help. They're there to do the right thing. They're trying to be with their community. The issue is that to me, you know, and the more I see articles like this and I see things firsthand and I hear things from people who see it firsthand, the volunteer system does not work.
The volunteer system
back in the
broken.
Day when you had, you know, when it was brand new and stuff and people were into it, that yeah, you can get a timely response from volunteer agencies. Some volunteer agencies, they do staff the squad building with X amount of personnel at all times so that they don't have to sit there and wait to gather everybody and then start responding. And then by the time the ambulance gets to the patient's side, you're talking, 10, 12 minutes.
Okay. Right. And so going back to my second comment, you get what you pay for.
Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, listen, I mentioned some of this, you know, on Twitter and just talk a little bit about, what we were going to talk about today. And my main thing was talking about volunteers when they turn on their own for volunteering, which is pretty much what happened here. They kind of turn on this guy for being a good volunteer and for trying to make what he thought was the right decision. Yeah, he didn't follow protocols or whatever. And and like I said, in some aspects I can fault the guy, some aspects I can. But, you know, people on Twitter were saying, well, how about you talk about, you know, volunteers, when volunteers hold back the profession of an industry, you know. And there's an element to that. I mean, there's an element of that as well, where the public sees articles like this and they start thinking, what the hell's going on in EMS?
Right. Right,
you know,
because everybody,
regardless of
paid or volunteer, reflects on us all.
What's that?
Everybody's actions, regardless if they're paid or volunteer, reflect on all of us.
I mean, listen, you get the guys in New York City a few recently where they were making racial comments on Twitter and whatnot, and that reflects on the entire profession. And you know, unfortunately, unlike, you know, some professions and some industries out there, we have piss poor public relations control, and it just runs amok when something goes wrong instead of it being somehow controlled or a positive spin put on it or whatever, you know. And to me, you know, the bottom line, this whole article and this entire thing, this sort of an issue about response to a call should not be an issue. You know, there should not be an issue of a timely response or having enough personnel to respond or having a qualified driver for a response. It's bullshit. You know, there should be enough people and paid individuals to respond appropriately to calls and to respond in a timely manner, no matter where you live. You know, and like you said, Josh, it's you get what you pay for. Nobody cares until something bad happens. You know what? If this seasoned kid happened to be a kid that was dying and he was having his last breaths and they thought it was a seizure,
he would have been a hero.
This would be a way different story.
Right. Right.
Jim?
Go ahead.
I think you have some valid points, but I don't think it's the volunteers in particular. I can narrow down what I think is wrong with the volunteer system, because the volunteer system in most places, well, I don't even want to talk most places. I can talk about only Suffolk County, is broken as a system, because the system presumes that there's interagency articulation, that people know where their equipment is, they know where their personnel are. In Suffolk County, we have enough personnel that and equipment. You've heard me talk of this before. There's something like 325 ambulances in Suffolk County. Does that sound like enough ambulances? Say yes. Because well, yeah, it is. Absolutely.
Yeah, sure.
It is, right. We have enough personnel that if we organized and disregarded the lines that separate my district from your district, so that if we had a firefighter driving the ambulance with an EMT on it, and another firefighter on another ambulance driving an ambulance with an ALS provider on it, we in Suffolk County could put 60 ambulances on the road 24/7, and the volunteers would only have to put in 16 hours a year, because that's how many volunteers we have. And that would be on top of the existing throw out the nets and catch what you can catch volunteer system. Now, I know that because when I left REMSCO, I was the chair of REMSCO 7-8 years ago, we actually had to make a protocol that said, hey, if you don't get a response, if you don't have a crew showing up telling you they're going to show up in 2 minutes, you have to go on a mutual aid for Delta and Echo calls. And there were corps, mostly the commissioners, that opposed this. They said, and the, yeah. Do I sound like that, or is it just you?
There was an audio problem. No, you're back. You're back now. It was a little internet hiccup. Getting to the core of these, why do you think? I mean, well, you and I have talked about this, Dave. Right. I mean, not why don't they get together, but why are there so many in the first place? And I think really what it is what's the reward system out there for volunteers? I mean, it's pretty clear what the reward system is in a paid system.
Yeah.
But, you know, now you're dealing with something less tangible because, you know, there's camaraderie, there's department recognition, there's the ability to be known in your community.
Conflict because you get different agencies and different, services that fight, you know, volunteer A doesn't want to go into volunteer B area, and volunteer B doesn't want volunteer A to go into their service area because they don't want to look like they can't get people out. And, you know, Dave, listen, you know.
And the public suffers.
You're putting a lot of numbers as far as how many people that would fill the ambulances.
Yeah.
And
we don't do that. We don't do it. I'm saying we could.
He pooled all the resources, Jim.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, though, is that, you know what, you can put that on paper, and even if you said that you were going to have that done, it would never happen because people volunteer, and they do it, and they do it half-assed. Okay, not all of them, but, you know, any place that I've worked where there's been volunteers, you see the same 7 people or whatever that are the sort of the core elements of the volunteer agency that respond to pretty much 90% of the calls, unless it's a big trauma job, a wreck, a cardiac arrest, something like that.
It's an adrenaline rush.
Yeah, and those are the people that, you know, are put pad the numbers for the agencies. And the agencies, we've got, we have 40 volunteers.
You're saying that they can do 200 responses, but it's on the backs of 5 people.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and again, it's not against the volunteers that are doing, like those 5 people, 7 people that are doing it, that where my complaint is. My issue is with the system itself that doesn't work. The system itself doesn't work. And I mean, the flip side of that, you can go on a whole nother tangent about, you know, the volunteers keep the paid people from getting paid and keep that growth, you know, from happening, because why pay, you know, pay for something that you're getting for free, and, you know, they don't, you know, garbagemen don't work for free, and cops don't work for free, and...
What I find kind of interesting is what I do see in these sort of mixed systems where some of the community fired houses that run an ambulance mostly run them off of volunteers, right? But they have, or they boast that they have a certain amount of paid medics. And I know a bunch of the guys that I work with go out to their communities on the weekend, and they pull a 24 or 12-hour shift at their local firehouse, and they're paid. So what I kind of find interesting is you have this entire system built up around volunteers, but they find that they still have to pay to have a certain level of service.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know...
I mean, listen, you know, and the problem with this argument is I always find it goes round and round, because you'll have people say... Oh, I'm just as professional as a paid person. I've done this many calls, and I've had this training, and, you know, and I know paid people are crap, and I, you know, I wouldn't trust a paid person with my family member, and all this nonsense. And it, to me, it's not about the individual when it comes down to it. It's about the framework that it's all built in, you know. And
I agree.
And I think that it
I think it also has some traditional aspects to our values and roots.
And I think that it's time that we put aside this traditional stuff, we put aside people's egos, and say, what is best for the communities that we serve? Is it the third dispatch, you know, for the volunteer squad, or is it to pay the local, whatever it is, you know, whatever local paid agency that's willing, most of these places are willing to put an ambulance in an area, you know, to do calls, you know, and pay them and recognize that, you know, sitting and waiting for a squad to get together is not the answer. You know, again, I don't want to go around in circles with it. You know, I see both ends, and I'm not saying that it's, you know, it's as dry.
I like where you just ended up.
What's
like
that?
I like where you just ended up. It's a system breakdown. It's a management breakdown. It's not a matter of who's doing it. And if I were running a system that needed dependable people, a lot of the people who volunteer wouldn't be in it.
Right. Well, that, you know, that's part of the problem, too, is that there's not enough vetting when it comes to the volunteer squads.
So, is that one of the big differences that we're talking about right now between the paid systems? Because we don't see this breakdown. We see different type of breakdown, but we don't see this particular service-related breakdown in the paid systems.
That's true.
Why is that?
They're getting paid.
Well, if that's the aspect between a community having a sort of a guaranteed, or as close as you can get to a guaranteed EMS response versus not, is paid, then why do we still have volunteers? Because it would think that we have
EMS. I can answer that because the municipalities that are in charge of them, which are not the – it's not the county. It's like I said, it's approximately 110 firefighting municipalities in Suffolk County alone, with each of them with five commissioners who are not about to give up their posts.
Thank you.
Okay? So
everyone's protecting their own little rice bowl.
Absolutely.
They don't want to give it up, and that's part of the issue. There's money involved coming in. You know, as much as it costs money to pay for these things, you know, there's still money coming in to run them. And
the commissioners aren't getting paid.
Well, no, but the titles that they have, I think, is part of it. You know. Well, the one thing I just want to end on this topic before we move on. Then we have to kind of talk about the sponsor a little bit, because a half an hour just flew by because of that rant. But
you said it was gonna.
The
first New Year's prediction.
Yeah, I know. I don't know, Dave, if you read the whole article or not, but at the end, the president there of the volley squad says that ambulances operated by paid services are considerably smaller and lighter than those used by volunteer companies. Garvis said, adding that paid services use converted vans and generally do not transport patients in emergencies. Go.
Oh, please. Oh, you know, I talk about guarding your rice bowl.
You know,
I think he's talking about that in his town.
No, but he's not.
But they have the certificate of
need. I wish I could. You know what? I wish I could say. Listen. I know this area, and the paid agencies that work that back up this area when they can't get an ambulance out. The paid agency that does it has, you know, bigger ambulances. They have van ambulances, but they've got the.
Why do they have bigger? Because they have the money to buy them.
You're asking me?
No, I'm just putting it out there. But even so, it's not, you know, this was truly, that was a gaffe on the part of the writer who did no research.
Yeah, I'd love to know. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's part of it. If you look at some of the comments, they're like, is there any research that they do? And you know what, not for nothing, this newspaper in the past that I've experienced with them has had sort of a record of bashing the EMS and paid EMS in general, for whatever reason. They had an issue a while back where they talked about the paramedic got into an accident, and the paramedic was severely injured, and you know, they kept calling ambulance driver, the whole thing.
Oh, this was that one. Oh, I remember that.
And then his boss wrote a big, long letter to the editor saying, listen, you know, I understand that comes out sometime, but, you know, this person is way more than an ambulance driver. He's a paramedic. He does this and that. And then they came back with this big argument as to why they use the term ambulance driver. You know, I mean, even this article, they kept calling this guy, this EMT that got suspended, an ambulance driver the entire time.
And what I was sort of pointing out before was that entire point of, you know, we're even when we're paid, we're kept under the auspices of a volunteer command, and so they really don't. They don't have that perspective. They don't have that understanding. And these are the people, you know, when you get to be a chief in a local community, you get to have some connections. You get to be known within within the local government. And so, you know, what you say carries more weight than the facts and figures that say you're not really providing the service that you propose to report to provide.
You know, and you're right, Josh. Because I remember when I worked in New Jersey, worked for a paid paramedic service, and we would respond to calls with the volunteers almost all the time. And if you stepped on their toes or they felt slighted in any way by you, they'd be on that phone to your boss, and it would be their word against yours, and you were wrong until proven otherwise. You know, the boss never took your side. Always pretty much, you know, took the volunteer agency side. And I'm talking about complaints, anything from they didn't believe my vital signs to they transported that patient. They didn't wait for us to get there, the transport type thing, you know. So, you know, listen, there's a lot of politics, I think, involved in this, which is why I go back to saying, you know, it's not against the volunteers themselves. It's just political sort of view.
But when we continue to provide
power struggle that goes on, you know.
And when you provide a service for free, you lose that power.
Right.
You lose that ability to negotiate.
Right.
Because you're providing it for free.
Right. It's true.
And I hate it because the truth is, for all of us, our roots are in the volunteer world.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I was a volunteer, but to me, back then, it worked. We staffed the garage. There were four people. There were two crews there at all times, and it was staffed. It wasn't call and run to the squad building, or maybe you're going to get somebody, maybe you don't get somebody, you know. And if you didn't, and then if the two crews go out because they're staffed, then you go to mutual aid. You know, that's a natural occurrence. But to be the norm, for the norm to be, you know, a call drops and you scramble to get a crew together, and maybe you get one, maybe you don't, you know, don't worry, Grandma, we'll get there when we can, you know, is ridiculous.
You know, look, I know we have to get to our sponsor. So we'll let's go on.
This topic can go
let me end on this thought, okay? Let me throw in this. Is that, you know, we in EMS always look towards that adage of the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And, you know, we're out there responding in all types of conditions under all types of threats to preserve and save life. And there has to be an aspect that we can take sort of that viewpoint for our own selves and say, really, truly, what will serve us, EMS, the best? You know, what is the greatest good for the greatest number of people within EMS?
Right. I think Spock said that.
He did something tantamount, but
he took it from someplace else. Okay.
Right. And so on.
Right.
I just got to talk about the sponsor, but we have a message from one of our listeners and guests as well before. So I'm going to play both of these segments here, guys. So if you want to mute yourself while we do that, and I'll see you in about 2 minutes.
This is Rom Duckworth from Rescue Digest. I can't call in live because I'm on the road coming home from Philly visiting family and friends, but I wanted to wish Jim, the whole EMS Office Hours crew, and everybody out there a warm, safe, happy, and prosperous New Year's for 2014.
This episode of EMS Office Hours is sponsored by EMS Manager. They have been consistently helping EMS agencies save time and energy with their innovative web-based software for staff scheduling and management. There's a mobile web app accessible from smartphones and other mobile devices with an easy-to-use web interface viewable from anywhere on the World Wide Web. You can check your own schedule, and managers and staff can oversee, manage, and make changes to employee schedules from anywhere. Dale Dow, who is the Deputy Chief of Fitch Rona Fire and EMS over in Fitchburg, Verona, in Wisconsin, says, "We began using EMS Manager about 6 months ago. Prior to using it, I spent a lot of time dealing with trade requests from members. Now they take care of their own trades. It's also very easy to check the schedule from anywhere. We'll never go back to paper scheduling. And it's affordable too. Pricing for EMS Manager is based on the size of your organization, and because it's web-based, your employee schedule and software is located in the cloud, meaning there's no additional IT cost to worry about. And there's always free training, free tech support, and free system software updates. So if you want this for your system, be sure to check out the free customizable trial of EMS Manager over at emsmanager.net. I want to thank EMS Manager for sponsoring EMS Office Hours and the other shows from the ProMed Network. EMS Manager is proud to support EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship and the support of what we do. Show your support for them. Take a few minutes and sign up for their free trial at emsmanager.net. Show them that you appreciate their support by trying out the software. Visit emsmanager.net for LaTeX EMS Manager for online employee scheduling and workforce management. And if you do sign up, guys, be sure to tell them that you heard it right here on EMS Office Hours.
Hi, this is John Broyles from Pekin, Illinois, EMT Basic and host of One Union 801, the webcast. Just want to take a second to let you all know that you're listening to Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on EMS Office Hours. Stay safe, y'all.
All right. Josh is still with me.
Yeah, I'm still here.
I was going to worry when we come back that we lose people.
Yeah, well, just out of lack of interest.
Yeah. So, Josh, the next thing I want to talk about, and I hope we can get one more topic in before the end of the show, is a post you made over on your Facebook page at facebook.com/wantnew. You had asked the question about, you said if you had a patient who you 99% suspected was having a heart attack, would you tell them you're having a heart attack? Mm-hmm. And seemed it was interesting. You got a lot of people liking it. You got a crap load of comments. A couple people went off on a tangent on their comments, but I mean, you know, you got a good, you got 64 comments on this thread.
When I usually get one or two.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's hard to
think I hit a nerve.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, and I wonder not just for heart attack. I think for a lot of calls. I mean. You know, is it something that we should be doing? Should we be telling patients the worst of what we think is going on with them? Should we sugarcoat it? Should we sort of evade the question? I mean, what were you trying to get at with that? What was your thoughts on it? What were you trying to sort of, you know, point out with that? That was good or bad to share that?
Let me go to this instead of answering that directly.
Because
it wouldn't it even be as interesting if I did just say yes or no, mm-hmm. good or bad. Thumbs up, thumbs down, right? You know, when we went back to our EMT basic class, we were told never lie to your patient. And that seemed to be a continuous thread through the education and the way that you handle yourself professionally. You don't lie to your patient.
Uh-huh.
But there's, I think, a difference, and not a subtle difference, between telling the unvarnished truth and lying, or using tact and putting things in a way that won't escalate. And I think, or won't escalate or change the patient's demeanor. And I think that's an important subtlety that needs to be noted. I think that a lot of people approach it as that this is the word, you never lie, and interpret that as saying, I've got to tell the truth no matter how bad it is, because that's the truth and that's what I got to do. And I think that a professional looks at it as, how do I manage this situation? You know, and it comes down to that old line, you know, for us married guys, you know, your wife walks into the room and says, does this dress make me look fat? Now, are you going to lie to your wife? And I think that, you know, the way that, you know, we learn to survive in this world is by framing our answers in a non-confrontational or a non-damaging way. And I think that's really where it comes down to. And what I was kind of surprised, you know, I had this sort of argument in real life. It wasn't really an argument, you know. I mean, when you're in front of the patient, you don't argue with your partner unless they're going to do something that's really going to harm the patient. You know, you try to take control of the scene and keep it all calm. But, you know, I had a discussion afterwards, and he was of the, you know, there was a point during the thing, is you're having a heart attack. And I'm like, and all of a sudden our patient started to get excited, started to say, you know, all sorts of things that they were going through. And actually, you know, on the monitor, their EKG started to change. And I'm like, what the, you know, blank did you say? Why did you do that? Why make your life harder? You know, and so that's why I've put it out there. And I was sort of surprised that there was a good amount of people who said, no, you got to tell the truth. I'm not saying lie. I am not at all. I'm saying, you know, manage your situation and manage your patient.
Hey, so, Josh.
Yeah.
The guy says to you, your patient says to you, I don't want to go to the hospital. Am I having a heart attack?
That's a different scenario.
So what would you say?
So now you're working to try to convince the patient to take an action that's in their best interest, correct?
Sure.
So you use all the tools available to you in an escalating format to try to get them compliance. I mean, just think about it. When you have an RMA, AMA, what do you say to the patient? If you stay home, sign my paper that says you refuse. But before you sign that, I want you to know two things. I want you to come with me to the hospital, and if you stay home, you might die. Right. Yep. So you're using that absolutely at that point in time, you know, you're using that to sort of break off at the confidence level the patient has in their own assessment of their situation, because I have a feeling that most people, if they thought they were going to die, would not choose not to go to the hospital. Most people. Not everybody, but I'm going to say the majority of people out there that we see, you know, call an ambulance because they're having a problem and think that we can fix it. They then refuse to go to the hospital because your calmness and you're saying, hey, you know what, you have a problem, it's not the end of the world. And they go, oh, it's not the end of the world? Okay, I don't have to go to the hospital. Well,
now it's the end of the world.
Now it's the end of the world, right.
Yeah, but what about the same thing where you're almost lying to them, too, because, you know, nowadays the RMA is seen as the biggest liability that we have. And you have people who, you know, who have pretty much nothing going on with them. They can RMA. You know that they can stay home. But you're supposed to tell them when they sign it, you know, this means that you're, you know, that if you stay home, you understand you could die.
I think that comes down to the practitioner.
You know, so you're almost, so you're lying again, but you're lying sort of on the flip side of that.
You know what? All bleeding stops eventually.
Yeah.
Am I lying?
Right. There's no mistake too big that we can't make it worse.
I heard that sigh, Dave. Go.
No.
have a swing at it. Go ahead.
What do you do with a person who has chest pain and they're willing to go to the hospital and they say to you, what do you think is wrong with me?
Well, that's a different thing, isn't it?
Well, I mean, so you're talking, Josh.
Are you going to send their anxiety level off the charts, or are you going to sort of keep them calm?
And Josh,
there's a way of addressing that without directly hitting them in the face with a wet pillow.
So, but Josh, are you saying are you talking about offering the information without being asked, or if the patient asks you, then you tell them what's going on? You know, you sit the patient down and you do the whole, you know, I'm informing my patient of everything that's going on. They asked me what was happening and I couldn't lie to them.
Right. And I think both of those answers are connected, but they're also very separate. One is, keep in mind, people call an ambulance, they don't want to know everything you're doing. I've had patients, we probably all had patients, tell us, you're telling me too much, or I don't need to know that, or, you know, just get me to the hospital, right? And you're saying, well, I'm going to start an IV, I'm going to do this, blah, blah, it's all.
Right, no, just get me there, do what you got
right,
to do.
Right. So there are some patients who just, you know, they know they're managing their own.
In their head, right, they're, I hear what you're saying. Something's happening, they're going to wait till they get to the hospital, but
right now
they just want to get there in one piece and they don't care what you do.
Right. You know, and then there's the other, so, you know, that's the aspect of maybe it is TMI, maybe, you know, keep your answers short and sweet, keep what you're doing, you know, mm-hmm. But again, that sort of comes down to that professional patter that you need to develop and that creates a patient rapport.
Yeah.
You know, whenever you have a rapport with anybody, there's information versus too much information versus appropriate information.
If you go to EMS Office Hours, you go to emsseo.com, there's actually a webinar that we did about the art of patient rapport that you can sign up for. That was done by Steve Whitehead from the emtspot.com.
And it's well worth it because, you know, these are the things that make us look good in the public eye or make us look like idiots.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is another aspect. Do you, in fact, know this person is having a heart attack? Because within your limited scope, and I say limited, even you, Dave, limited scope of training.
Even him?
Because he's my my 12-loop teacher. I mean, I have to, know. But, you know, look, there's only a certain amount that we
January
can provide. January 26th
is a new 12-loop course coming up. If you're interested, you can. What?
But that, I mean, you teach an awesome class, Dave, and you have a lot of insight into what's going on. I'm not just plugging this here. It's true. Okay, but with all of that, can you absolutely tell beyond a shadow of a doubt, end to end, that that person's having a heart attack? Or could there be other abnormalities that could cause ST elevations?
Absolutely. But you're telling me you guys don't do troponin levels in the field?
I stopped doing that because my troponin level regulator broke.
Yeah, you know what? The iStat is just too difficult to set up. Yeah, it's just a pain in the ass. It's messy.
Yeah, I don't tell them any. I would never tell anybody.
Listen, you know,
Josh. So, Dave, what would you say?
What would I say?
Yeah.
After I run my 12-lead EKG,
I would say,
you know what? I think I have some serious concerns, and we need to go to the hospital.
Oh!
You have tombstones. What?
You're right.
No.
Tombstones?
What's those? Don't worry about it.
You run a 12-lead EKG on somebody, there's nobody who doesn't know that you're supposed to come up with an idea. So I say to them, I have serious concerns. And when they say to me they don't want to go, then I get more assertive, just like you said.
Yeah.
And you know what? Even when, how about the person whose EKG doesn't show they should be going to, doesn't show a STEMI or anything? I look at it and I say, I've had patients with EKGs like this who've died.
Right.
Even though it's a normal EKG.
You have to go by, Dave, like you said, you're going by your assessment, your clinical impression, what's going on, patient history, all that stuff. And then when you get a patient that is either being transported or wants to refuse and they ask you what's going on, you're going to tell them, you know, what you think it is and follow it up with, this is why we're going to the hospital to get further testing and whatnot. And when we get there, I'm sure they'll be able to give you a more definitive answer. But, but in the back of the ambulance, this is what I'm thinking might be happening. I have a strong suspicion that you have something going on and this is why we're going, the problem with that thing, too, is that, nowadays, especially with things like strokes and heart attacks, we do 12 leads and we do, stroke scales and all that to try to give us a better picture of what's happening with the patient. And then we're calling the hospital,
And they're right there.
And then, I got a guy coming in, and, he's got an inferior wall, MI. I'm going straight to the cath lab? Okay, great. I'm transmitting the EKG, and, I'm going to go straight to the cath. And then the patient's like, what are you talking about? What's a cath lab? Now you open up a can of worms that's all over the back of the ambulance, and you're not getting them back in the can.
Right.
Right.
But that's all tact and...
That's what I usually say when they ask me that. I say... I don't know. I'm driving. I ask my partner, and I get in the driver's seat, and I peel away.
That's really sad. But, this comes back to, there are so many aspects of us, of our job, that dictate what a professional is, right? I mean, there's the guys, and we've all seen them, the guys who show up to the MVA in flip-flops. What the hell? Or what I even love is this is in the paid as well, the ones that aren't monitored as closely, is the guys that get off.
The
guys who get off, their shirt is untucked. They have cap on backwards.
Yeah. Those are the people that I bitch about. I had a guy that did that walking around a fire scene, a major fire scene. He's walking around. He just woke up, and he's walking with his boot laces 2 feet behind him.
So back up and say...
Get me started. Back on our first topic, I don't want to go there.
But what's the difference between that when you're talking about professionalism and somebody who goes and does something purposely to upset the patient, or even maybe not purposely, just because they're just idiots? What's the difference?
Well, I think I think, like you said, Josh, is a certain element of this job where you've got to be able to know how to build a rapport with your patient and know how to speak to patients and family members and public. And, you know, this is part of our job overall. I mean, you know, and it's something that you develop being out there in the field, you know, knowing how to speak to all these different people. And you speak to them in different ways because of belief. You speak to the police officer one way, the nurse one way, the family member one way, the patient one way. And you have to know how to do that. And if you don't know how to do it, or you're not doing it, you know, the right way, then you're going to have those issues like you're talking about, where you're going to be upsetting patients and upsetting family members and pissing off cops and, you know, and having nurses look at you like you know what the hell you're doing. You know, it's all part of sort of that, you know, that way of speaking to people.
It doesn't come. You can't teach that in
ENT school.
That's bullshit. I think that you can teach that. I don't think that it necessarily is going to happen in 120 hours of training, mind you. But I think that you can teach that.
You can teach an awareness of it.
Okay.
I don't think it should be as clear-cut, like you said early on, about how they teach in school. Never, don't lie to your patients. You know, that's the
without
train.
Explanation
now
of what
train.
They mean. Because when you distill down the message of be honest and truthful to your patients, when you distill it down to save space in the textbook, it comes out as don't lie to your patients. And then the distortion happens where the message is lost, because there's no longer, it's too greatly filtered. The real message is, you know, communicate. Communicate honestly and openly, but you're supposed to also be calming. You're supposed to also be reassuring. You're supposed to also be empathetic.
No.
Yeah, give it a shot.
You know, I don't know. I think there's two different ways to it. I think, hey, Tim, are you still on the line? I didn't see you sitting there. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Hey,
how
you doing?
Happy holidays.
Hey, Tim. Happy New Year to you.
You too. Since I commented on what you posted, I wanted to call up and say basically what I think is the same thing you were saying. And we're not 100% sure of any diagnosis, or even 99% sure. So telling the patient that they're having a heart attack, I almost never use the word heart attack, because what does that really mean? You know, it's not a medical term anymore.
And you know what?
It's kind of like showing off. Telling you that you've got something when I don't really know what's going on.
That's true.
And you know, in reply to what you had written when I wrote that, I didn't really get it out as well as I wanted to. But you know, you could.
I didn't have a chance to see it yet.
Okay, but you where we're at is you as a practitioner. You might not be 100% sure, but you've seen enough cases and read the signs and symptoms and know the family history and know everything else to yourself, that you yourself may be 100% sure, meaning you're willing to bet your mortgage on it that this patient's having a heart attack. But you're not going to, but if the end-all end says it, you know, you can't be 100% sure, so why use that as a point to upset the patient?
Yes. If the patient asks me, do you think I'm having a heart attack, I'll tell them, trying to find the right terminology based on what they've been saying to say the words that will be least upsetting to them, but will still be honest. You know? What my monitor shows me is that there are changes that suggest a heart attack.
In my experience, suggests that I could have my strong suspicions, but honestly, we won't find out unless we get to the hospital. And really, that would be the best place for you to be to have a final answer. Maybe final answer isn't great language either.
Yeah.
Cardiologists aren't right about whether a patient's having a heart attack all the time either.
That's true.
You know, and it's kind of funny because in the end, this job that I did, I went back and I was actually I talked to the doc, and it turned out that, you know, the guy that we brought in, even though he had ST elevations and all the right leads and reciprocal changes and all the right leads, wasn't having an MI right there and then. He was having some other abnormality, which was caught, but he wasn't having an MI.
And in the hospital, they have troponins and other things to go by that we do not have. So why, based on very limited information, do we want to make a definitive statement?
But
So
let me throw something else out at you, Tim. Let's say we have all the modern things and we are able to measure troponins on the spot and everything else, and that raises our level of suspicion, so to speak, or our level of confidence in our diagnosis, all right? Would you still tell a patient that that was what was going on when you couldn't do anything to correct it?
In order to transport...
Let's say they're decided
to do what I can.
You don't have to convince them to transport.
Whatever they ask me, I'll try to answer them in a way that's least likely to get their adrenaline flowing.
And that's a professional, folks.
Huh. Well, I don't know if they're there.
I paid you a damn compliment, Tim, please. It's hard enough for me to do that.
Yeah, I thought a lot of the answers on that thread were pretty interesting, Josh. You know, I thought it was very insightful, a lot of that stuff going on there. You know, it's just a different take that people have. But I think Tim made a great point, which when he said, when you just come out and say it to people like that and you tell them that type of thing, it's almost like you're trying to show off, you know.
Yes.
You're trying to somehow show that you have some kind of inside knowledge or something. And I think that's where the problem runs in. I think you do have people out there that do that too often, you know. They feel they have this right because they were told somewhere during EMT school, never lie to your patient. And now they have that opportunity to not lie, you know. And that's where, I guess, why you got such a, when you post something like that, you get such a wide range of feedback because you do have that, I guess, you know.
But what do you think it is that people interpret it as, I must tell the blunt truth at any cost? Or that the truth is a damaging thing?
I think there's levels of EMS providers out there that don't know how to speak to patients or that don't want to take the time to use tact when they're talking to the patient because they feel the job that they're on is an annoyance rather than part of their job, you know, and they're feeling, oh, now I'm going to teach this guy a lesson for calling me.
You know, there's...
I was sleeping, and he woke me up. I'm going to teach him a lesson now. I'm going to tell the brutal truth. You might lose that arm. You're having a stroke. You're having a heart attack. I mean, it's hard enough when they hear you talking on the radio, and you've got to give a report where they hear you, you know, kind of alluding that you've got something critical coming in without turning around and being blunt with them, you know.
Right.
I think, like you said before, so a lot of these people, they don't want to know or... they're just trying to deal with their own emergency in their head as it's unfolding, and they don't need you there pointing out, you know, some of the details that maybe they don't necessarily want to hear. You
right.
Know? So.
I think that's important. I think that, you know, and I sort of alluded to the same thing that Tim did, that, you know, I think that sometimes it's just bravado, that sometimes they're just trying to show off in a own weird way that, you know, they have this knowledge of this other person. But I think that there's another aspect that somebody brought up, and it was kind of interesting that they said, look, these people don't know any better. They're just like cookbook medics, you know, and they actually use that term. You know, they can follow the protocol as it's written, and they can't deviate from it. So when
I'm going to turn this around, if you
go
don't
ahead.
Mind. I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
I would like you to do it. No, go ahead.
I'm going to ask you, if you were the patient, and somebody ran, and you had chest pain, and somebody had, ran a 12 lead EKG on you, you, the paramedic, you know, you know, we kind of think we have some immunity from disease because we're paramedics, but what would you want them to tell you? Well, I'm going to tell you that I'd want to see the EKG.
Well,
just
yeah.
So you know. How about you? Would you want to see it?
No.
As a paramedic patient?
As a patient
with the knowledge that I'm a medic and I know how to read an EKG?
I'm talking about Josh, period.
Well,
not a hypothetical
patient.
That's
who I am. Okay, fine. Yes, I would want to see the EKG. I would want them to scrub the hub before they gave me any medicine, you know? I mean, these are things that I go nuts that I see people do all the time. How many times it makes me nuts when I watch somebody and I see them starting an IV without cleaning the site? You know, I mean, these are things that make me nuts. So do I trust everybody? Would I trust everybody with my particular health? Maybe, but I'd also want to see it.
You only get the ambulance that shows up. That's it.
Right, right. So, you know, with that understanding and my understanding that I know how to read EKGs, yeah, I would want to see the EKG. But what I'm saying is, with that, is that that doesn't change the aspect of how a message is delivered.
I agree.
It's interesting. We have a guy in the chat room saying, you know, he's talking about convincing a patient to go to the hospital is showing – he doesn't think convincing a patient to the hospital is going off. And Joseph Moore, Joe, if I can call you Joe, it's not a matter – you know, we're not under the scenario where we're trying to scare the patient into going to the hospital that they're refusing. We're trying to make our case as bluntly as possible. We're just talking about a situation where the patient wants to know what's going on, in this case, this was the case in my particular instance where the patient did want to know what was going on, and my partner said something in a very blunt way without 100% certainty. And I think there's no need for that because it ended up upsetting the patient and causing an incident while we were, causing the patient to further have issues going on, you know, that probably, not saying 100% that they wouldn't have had these, that they wouldn't have had the greater EKG changes during our treatment. He might have anyway, but, you know, he might not have. And I always go on the basis of if you're having a heart problem, keep them calm. And this was something that, you know, was visible.
So you wouldn't say something like, I would tell you, but any shock I may say would
absolutely
make you worse.
Not. No, I will. What I'm going to use is tact. You know,
right.
that.
You look up front and you tell the driver, go fast, this guy's crapping out.
Yeah, right. I'm not going to start screaming and waving. No.
I mean, really,
there's a way of doing it. You can say, sir, you know, what I see here, you know, we have certain diagnostic capabilities. You thought this was important enough to call an ambulance. And to be honest with you, I see some things that do concern me. And I'd like to get you to the hospital so they can do further tests and have better experts there to be able to handle or treat what I suspect or what I see here.
Right.
That sounds good.
Yeah. Listen, guys, we've got to wrap it up. We're past the 8 o'clock mark, but I just wanted to, of course, announce that we did go over 200,000 listeners for 2000. Yeah. Before 2014. I mean, that's pretty cool. It's a pretty good marker for us, I think, that we surpassed that. We actually, the last I checked just before the show, we were at 200,371 listens. So
that's impressive.
Pretty cool, I think. So that is a pretty good number. So hopefully we will continue that increase. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking forward to it.
We talk about important things here. I think what needs to be in the conversation nationally. I think that people, you know, who's doing what there?
Sounds like a chair.
Doesn't sound like me. I'm not moving.
Oh. So what I, the only other thing I want to cover, guy, before we go on, since I think Tim is still with us, I want to just
go over.
Oh,
you got me back on.
Yeah, I just want to go over a question that I got.
One of the things I would add is that it's like somebody goes to the doctor and they want to know how long do I have to live. It's not why you go to the doctor. And doctors are not spending right. all that time in medical school to guess how long you have to live. If you call 911, you're not calling up to find out, am I having a heart attack so I can panic? Or, you know, am I calling for somebody to treat me on the way to the hospital where they can continue right. to treat me, and later on they can tell me what to do.
But we can provide the panic, Tim, at no extra charge.
Are you?
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. What?
We can provide the panic at no extra charge.
And we often do.
It's a free service.
It's free. No, nothing extra for that.
Call that mad on.
Yeah. So I wanted to just go over a question I got from somebody, and I just want to get your guys' take on it. And it was asking if I thought it was okay if somebody's on, let's say, like an interfacility truck or even a 911 truck, and the entire time they're listening to the radio for everything, you know, but the call that they're on. You know, they're not on the call. They're listening to everything else that's going on around them and not focusing on the call that they're on. And they, you know, wondering my take on if I thought it was okay or not okay, you know, for that type of thing.
I thought you weren't going to say the last
call. I think
about
they should automatically
get
every other call.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You know, I guess the thing is, you know, if someone's on an interfacility transport, they don't necessarily want to be there. So the entire time while they're, you know, they have grandma in the back, or they're taking grandma to, you know, to a cath lab or taking her home or something, they've got that third ear listening to the 911 radio and, you know, making comments about who had, oh my God, they had that call, oh my God, this is going on type thing, you know. And is it okay if it's not affecting the transport, really? You know, is it all right if they do that? And to me, I don't think it is all right. I think it's a distraction. I think you come off of being unprofessional to the patient or even your partner, for that matter, who needs you as a partner, not as somebody who's looking at, you know, something else over in the corner while they're with you.
It's like having your surgeon, what's going on in the other bay while they're doing surgery on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I was brand new, we had a standby for drowning. And they said, you know, just stand by in your station. We'll call you and let you know what's going on. But I went down and went off and laid down to go to sleep. And everybody said, well, how can you do that? You know, we've got to know what's going on. Like, they're going to call us. That's what they do. They have a pager that they gave you. And when you have a call, they will set that pager off. He said, but we've got to know ahead of time so we can be in the right position. Like, well, if you haven't been dispatched to that position, you're going to be in the wrong position unless they're comfortable with you floating around your district.
Right.
My take is...
But we try to anticipate what's going to happen, and we're not good at it.
I'm not going to agree with that, Tim. I think that we can anticipate what's going on. I think that sort of, that is some of the things that we are supposed to do, you know, is let's say you hear that there's a drowning and, you know, okay, you don't want to leave the station till there's a call. Just using your example, you might want to just make sure that your drowning, whatever you have for that type of call is, you know, locked and ready to go, you know, ready, you know, for you.
7mm or 8mm?
Yeah, right.
Well,
Being
prepared is one thing.
Yes,
but,
and I want to my feeling on is very similar to yours. I think it's unprofessional. And more importantly, I think that when you are distracted by other nonsense, you are no service to your partner or the patient. And your job at that point in time is to your partner and the patient. So I happen to have been in that situation many times.
Me too.
And I hate it. I hate it. It makes me nuts.
Yeah, I mean, you're sitting there and you're taking care of one patient, and they go, "Oh my God, there's a cardiac arrest down the block." All right, but we're here, so there's nothing we can do about it. We're already assigned to a call.
Honestly, you know, I turned my radio off when I get to the.
That's the thing too. I don't understand why people have this desire. Like Tim said, if when they need us, they're gonna call us. You know, I don't see the need to sit there and monitor every little thing. I mean, I recently had a thing where, you know, they're so busy monitoring the radio, they're not monitoring it properly. They volunteered for a call thinking it was a call in their area and it was another unit's area, and then we ended up driving longer than what we wanted to because it was the other unit's call to begin with, but we jumped on it because they were so wrapped up in the call type and not listening to where it was, that even I knew that we were going too far, that we were going to be responding too far away from where we were, you know. But it's like you just can't, you know, I don't know, you just, people get wrapped up in it. I think that speaks to
what Tim was saying, is that, you okay, now you're in the wrong position to where you need
right,
to be.
Right, and that's what happened. You're so busy trying to jockey for a position or jockeying for the better response that you end up responding to the wrong place, or you're responding inappropriately because you're so caught up into trying to do something or trying to get a jump on it. I mean, that's just basic, you know, just even just monitoring the radio in general. I mean, I'm not even talking about the original question, which was, you know, if you're already on a call or you're doing something like interfacility transports and you're sitting there the entire time thinking about the next best thing that you could be doing.
Even if you're doing an emergency, because I think that there's a very important thing once you make patient contact.
Yeah,
is that your focus shifts.
Yeah, it should.
Right. And, you know, you get these guys who sit there and they turn the radio up as they're listening to lung sounds or taking a patient history so they can hear what's going on to other units. Well, you know, what's the point? You're engaged.
Right.
Forget about it.
Right, exactly. All right, I just wanted to make sure. I did a Monday
kick him out of the room.
So, what's that, Tim?
Kick him out of the room. If the person responding with you is listening to the radio loud enough that they're interfering with patient care, kick him out of the room.
You know, go outside, Tim,
if you want to play.
You know, Tim, what I do is I reach over and I turn the radio off.
Or throw it out the window.
Yeah, right. Well, then you have
to. They take more of a beating.
Yeah. I tell you. Well, you know, I did a Monday Minutes on that topic because it really, I started thinking about all the times that I've been in so many similar situations, and I thought it was a good idea to sort of talk about, you know, staying focused and focusing on the task at hand and all. So I did a Monday Minutes. I wanted to kind of bring it out to you guys and see your take on it as well. You know, on that also. So, well, why don't we end there, guys? We're about 20 minutes over our allotted time. So, I appreciate you guys jumping in.
Why not just go through to the new year?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
We're gonna have a marathon show.
Some of these topics we had tonight, we probably could go on and on for quite a while. So,
time flies.
Yeah, it does. It does. Tim, but thanks for calling. Sorry I had you on hold for about 7 minutes or so. I didn't realize you were there. I was looking at the Facebook page. So, sorry about that. It's fine. I was looking at the Facebook page, and I was looking at your comments on the Facebook page, and meanwhile, you're on hold and my other screen. So, all right. So, well, guys, listen.
Well,
I got to listen
to Josh and nod in agreement.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yes. As a year-end prediction, this is...
I know.
Got to be a crazy New Year.
Got to make a New Year resolution never to let that happen again.
You know what? Sometimes, guys, great minds do think alike.
Uh-huh. I don't know what it leaves me and Dave, but
whatever. Out in the cold.
I know.
Absolutely.
All right, guys, listen, have a happy New Year. Thanks for popping in. And hopefully we'll see you. We'll see you.
Happy
everybody
New Year.
See you all in 2014.
Sounds good, Jim.
Sounds right to me. Be safe.
All right, everybody, that's it for us. Thanks for listening. Appreciate your time. Don't forget to comment on the blog at emfofficehours.com or even right here at Blog Talk Radio if you are listening live. And we will see you in 2014. Until then, as always, guys, Jim Hoffman, stay safe.